John chapter 6 starts with this feeding miracle in which Jesus feeds 5,000 people miraculously with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Jesus then spends the rest of the chapter explaining what that miracle meant in a number of different ways, often repeating himself. I'm sure if you've ever sat with a loved one who continues to tell you the same story every time you get together, it almost feels like that in some ways, that Jesus is kind of reiterating his point a number of different ways. And those times where we sit with folks who tell us the same stories over and over, we put up with it because those people mean something to us. It's a way of abiding with them, a word that Jesus actually uses here. So we're at the end of this passage. Jesus has talked about eating flesh and drinking blood an awful lot, and it has a lot of different ways that this passage has been read through the centuries. So because this is the last Sunday on this passage, I figured that we would have it all figured out by now. That I would write a paper on it, and then that would be it. Now, in all likelihood, we're not going to actually figure it out today. But the hope is that we can get a little bit closer with the passage that has been important for us. Do we have any thoughts, questions, observations about the passage that Renata read today, about the response that the folks had to Jesus' message? Yes, Wayne.
That first of all, no one comes to the Father except no one comes to God except God calls him. He gives us some exclusives, right? We apparently ask, if you have any shred of belief in God, that's God's work in you.
Yes. Yeah, Wayne pointed out the passage, the verse that I was trying to avoid today. So the verse where Jesus says that no one comes to Jesus or comes to believe in Jesus except as that is granted by the Father. It's a difficult passage. It's certainly been used throughout centuries to make Christianity a very exclusive thing, or to justify certain beliefs. You know, those folks over there just don't get it, like we do, because God didn't allow them to participate in this truth. A couple of things about that passage, though. You know, I love the idea, Wayne, that there's something of God living in all of us, and we can respond to that. So there is human agency there for sure. But I think it's an interesting passage to not try to figure out entirely, to allow it to be a little unsettling, and to think about, you know, in what ways do we maybe not use this specific language, but we use exclusionary terminology or ideas to keep people out or to explain why they're not here. Thank you, Wayne.
Here.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the reference back to the Old Testament, in other words, to the Jews or in the so what is the context of that part of this is very different from the Jewish couple, or is it just a reference to the conditional belief in God?
Yeah, so what is... Does this have a reference to the Hebrew Bible? You know, the idea of being a chosen people? Yeah, I would say so. I think that Jesus is perhaps redefining what it means to be a chosen people here, and that it's maybe not hereditary or based on your ancestors. And I think that what's happening here is that Jesus shifts scenes. He's talking to a big crowd of of folks from Galilee, the 5,000 who followed him, and he's also talking in the synagogue. So whatever message Jesus is proclaiming, he is proclaiming it to everyone around him, which I think does open up this passage just a little bit. But yeah, there's clearly a theme of who's chosen by God here, for sure. Yeah, David.
Kind of back to what Wayne was saying, I did one of those BeliefNet online tests where you answer 25 questions and then they tell you which faith you line up with the most. And one of the questions is, is the way to salvation only through Christianity? And of course, I said no. And of course, I end up basically as an atheist on their test. but this ties into that, I think, with the Eucharist as well. And are we sort of connecting with Christianity is the only way to salvation?
Yeah.
And how do you discuss that? It's an uncomfortable thought, at least for me.
It is. It's an uncomfortable thought. I think, I took the same test and came out an atheist too. But I didn't have any other skills, so I just went into ministry anyway. So I think that there are two ways of thinking about religious pluralism. There are probably a lot more than two, but we don't have time for that. The first way we think about religious pluralism is that everyone is kind of after the same thing. That the metaphor commonly used is everyone has a blindfold on and they're all reaching out and they're touching different parts of an elephant. Right? We've maybe heard that metaphor before. I think what some scholars and thinkers that I enjoy reading talk about is it's not an elephant. Everyone is going up the mountain, but they're all different mountains. Because Islam and Hinduism and Christianity and paganism and other world religions and local religions are not after the same thing. And that's okay. The mountains are different mountains. And there may be some commonalities around compassion or charity or peace or things of that nature. But they are distinctly different mountains. I am Christian because I grew up Christian, and the stories of Jesus resonate with me more than other stories. Someone who grew up Hindu may simply resonate with those stories more closely than our stories, because they're different stories. It is kind of interesting to think about that. Yeah. What else? Yeah, Andrea. Yeah, I think both in some of Jesus's, as Jesus is depicted in some of the Gospels, but especially in the epistles of Paul, there is this idea that God initiates everything. And that we do have human agency in this, but that God is the ultimate initiator. God provokes us to do something in some form or fashion. And that is... that's a major thread through the histories of Christian thought, for sure.
We exist because of God.
Yeah, the kind of first cause type of thing. Yeah. What else? Yeah, Bill. Yeah, yeah. I think Bill points out that everyone hears and learns differently, right? And I think that one of the guiding issues in John chapter 6 is that Jesus is mostly being read literally here. They're thinking about eating flesh and drinking blood, which is taboo in every culture, eating flesh, or most cultures. And they can't get over those words. I'm sure I've shared this with you before, but some folks have described religion. Religion is like poetry. No, nobody likes poetry. because it plays. It plays with words in ways that when we step into these doors, sometimes we just want, just give me some encouragement for the week and tell me what I need to be doing, you know? But Jesus doesn't always let us get away with that. I mean, I feel like these passages just provoke way too much thought, so that we have something to chew on and not just do throughout the week. There are a couple of interesting Greek problems here for, I love Greek, I'm a Greek nerd when it comes to the New Testament. But Jesus is having this back and forth with his disciples in this passage. And his disciples say, this teaching is too difficult for us. The Greek word for this, for the word difficult here, is the same word that we use when we say sacrilegious. So his disciples are saying, this is breaking with our custom. This is wrong, literally wrong. And then Jesus responds by saying, is this teaching, here, let me find it again. It says, this teaching is difficult, which means this teaching is sacrilegious, in which he replies, does this offend you? That Greek word for offend is, does that cause you to sin? Does that cause you to be separated from God in some form or fashion? So there's something very serious happening, and that's why we see this kind of mass exodus of disciples from Jesus at this point. Yeah, Andrea.
The other thing about this passage of drink my blood, it goes all the way back to Abraham and the first sacrifice that, you know, it began with our whole faith, which is Judaism, was that without the spilling of blood, there's no remission of sin, and that Jesus was the sin offering. He was the Passover lamb on the way out of Egypt, and that
yeah, so I think that this passage is read a couple of different ways depending on who's reading it. I think that, you know, to a Jewish audience, this language sounds very much like temple sacrifice. And it evokes the language of their ancestors. To the more Hellenized cultures that this gospel was going around to, it would have evoked something very different. And if they could get over the literal reading of it, it probably had something more to do with the idea of consuming something that brings divinity within you.
Did he clarify it in the next sentence?
So, which sentence?
The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and motion. And that meant to me that not the flesh is spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that we often equate this passage with the sacrifice, atonement, cross, death, resurrection, and all of that. Here, Jesus seems to be talking about his words and his actions. So I think that's something for us to consider. I think that sometimes as people of faith, we have a tendency to kind of boil down everything salvific or everything in our faith down to like the last 3 days of Jesus. And I think that here and in other places, there are a lot more verses about Jesus. And the idea of consuming Jesus, while it sounds kind of disgusting, the idea that we talked about a couple of weeks ago is that we are experiencing this person. We are learning the teachings, we are hearing these stories over and over, and we are bringing them into our very selves, and they are becoming part of us. So by eating Jesus's flesh and drinking Jesus's blood metaphorically, we are taking in the life and teachings of someone who taught compassion. And we're trying to figure out along the way what that means to us and how we can act on it. Now, we have the Spirit of God that provokes us into new expressions of that all the time. That's why we're still reading the same book after 2,000 years or so and finding some new thoughts and new meanings in it. But know that this is difficult stuff because most of Jesus' disciples left after that. Yeah, Wayne, final thought?
Yes, sir. I may add one more. I want to remember that John writes 65 years after Jesus' death, and 65 years after the first time they drink bread and drink wine together and have his presence. And I think that's the key word for me is that first word, survive in me. Abide is a wonderful word.
Yeah, so we're talking about the incarnation, which is a big churchy word. And at Jesus' time, there were kings and tyrants who declared themselves as deities, left and right. It was a way primarily of maintaining power. Jesus is not using this language to maintain power, but to spread a message. I think that's kind of interesting. And when we participate in this meal, or we are simply here together chewing on a passage, or we are drinking decaffeinated coffee down at coffee hour, we are embodying that presence of God in some form or fashion.
Amen.
Amen. I think that's my cue. Yes? I thank you for allowing me to walk through this kind of sticky chapter with everyone. It's been a lot of fun to kind of have some back and forth and listen to thoughts and answer questions when I can or make them up when I couldn't. We will have this passage again in 3 years. as the lectionary goes. So it'll be interesting to see just what we do with it then.